from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
China is responsible for nearly half of our entire trade deficit. They break the rules in every way imaginable.
That was President Trump, then candidate Trump, during the 2016 presidential campaign, hitting one of his familiar rallying points, criticism of China's trade practices. This week, he's set to meet for the first time with the president of China, Xi Jinping, at his estate in Florida, and the two are expected to discuss trade and policy towards North Korea, as well as many other things. And we'll preview that meeting and take a look at the current state of U.S.-China relations, all coming up on Forum after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Throughout the 2016 presidential campaign, President Donald Trump harshly criticized China, calling it the greatest abuser in the history of this country and even promising to label it a currency manipulator on his first day in office. But on Thursday, China's President Xi Jinping will meet with President Trump at his estate in Florida. The two-day summit comes amid tense relations between the two nations over differing strategies toward North Korea, China's military presence on islands in the South China Sea, and, as we've seen and heard, Trump's repeated criticism of China's trade policy. In this opening forum hour, we'll preview President Xi's visit and we'll discuss the current state of U.S.-China relations. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. I want to welcome back Orville Schell, who is actually in East Bay today, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society, now in New York City, and also working on a novel assiduously. Orville, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
Also want to welcome Anna Han, who is joining us this morning as well. She's associate professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law, specializing in Chinese law and international business transactions. Welcome, Anna Han.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Susan Shirk, who joins us from New York City. She's chair of the 21st Century China Center, School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. And welcome to the program, Susan Shirk.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And let me actually begin with you, Susan Shirk, because I know that you folks at UC San Diego have put out a report and have expressed growing concern to address what really are damaging, mutual interests that we may have with the Chinese, interlocking economies, if you will, or certainly interpenetrating economies. Just wondering if you're sanguine about really this meeting at Mar-a-Lago. You feel anything really will be accomplished?
Well, I hope so, but I confess to being a bit worried about it. The task force you're referring to, actually, our center at UC San Diego collaborated with Orville Center at Asia Society to gather together 20 China experts, many of whom had served in government, Republican and Democratic administrations going as far back as the Nixon administration, because we were concerned that U.S.-China relations was not going in a good direction and that maybe we needed to revise our approach to China now that China had changed, not just becoming more powerful, but also starting to act in ways that were detrimental to U.S. interests. So we got together to write a set of recommendations for the new president, of course, not necessarily expecting Donald Trump to be the president. But we nonetheless produced this report, and it really is a pretty good game plan for President Trump to follow should he choose to do so. And we did brief some members of the Trump administration. But the highest priority issues on our first year work plan in our report, as well as I believe at this summit, will be North Korea and the unbalanced trade and investment relationship.
Well, those are the two things that President Trump has singled out as well, talking a good deal about trade imbalance and needing to put pressure on North Korea, particularly because of the desire to shut down their nuke program and ballistic program as well. Economic sanctions, though, certainly are not necessarily what the Chinese have wanted, and the Chinese have not necessarily put the kind of pressure on North Korea that's been called for, not only by President Trump, but previous administrations. In fact, the movement on North Korea seems to be at a standstill and has been at a standstill. And if anything, we're hearing more threats from Kim Jong-un. So one wonders where we can take this. I mean, if it is a priority, what can be actually accomplished at a meeting in Mar-a-Lago?
Well, you know, we need to give real sanctions a chance, and that requires getting China's full cooperation. And what that means is not just stopping the coal imports, which they have now committed to do, although it's not clear how well that's being implemented, but also cracking down on these North Korean front companies that are based in China. And the Chinese could do that. They could also stop all financial transactions through Chinese banks. The big banks have already done that, but smaller banks are still dealing with North Korea. So that there are reasons we can talk about why the Chinese have been reluctant to do that related to their own security interests.
But you sound optimistic now, that China may be moving in a different direction.
Well, actually, I have a little ray of hope, but what it'll take from our side is a sincere commitment to try negotiations again, because China's not just going to do this as a favor to Donald Trump, and his tough talk in advance of the meeting is not going to persuade Xi Jinping. We're going to have to show that we're willing to make a good faith effort to get negotiations going again. And we probably also have to talk with China about the possibility that if they squeeze North Korea really, really tight, there could be a collapse of that regime. I don't think it's likely, but it could happen. And the Chinese are very worried about that. And that if we have a reunified Korea, we're willing to talk with China about the disposition of U.S. forces on the peninsula, because that's something China really worries a lot about. A unified Korea under a sole government with U.S. forces right on the Chinese border.
So Zinchuk, again, is chair of the 21st Century China Center, School of Global Policy and Strategy at University of California, San Diego. And Anna Han is associate professor of law here at Santa Clara University School of Law and specializes in Chinese law and international business transactions. Let's talk with you, Professor Han, about trade. There is a reality at this point that needs to be pointed out, that President Trump during the campaign spoke very harshly about China. It was a great deal of his rhetoric. I'm sure the Chinese were quite aware of this and were sensitive to it. And when he talked about maybe looking at the one China policy and possibly moving toward Taiwan, it upset them a great deal, but he's backed off from that. I'm not sure how much he's going to back off from trade, though, and how much really China will be receptive to talking about the trade imbalance, particularly since, and let me go to you with this question, because I think it's on everybody's mind. If he does try to act as tough as he's talked, it could seriously lead to trade wars.
Well, I think that's certainly, if he acts that way, I agree with you. But I think this particular meeting, hopefully, is to avoid that particular scenario. In my mind, the talks have been very harsh and very critical, and yes, the Chinese are very aware of it. But this meeting is intended to sort of size up how serious this administration is going to act on the threats that were spoken during the campaign stage. And I think this is actually, in my mind, Xi's top priority, is to figure out exactly whether this administration intends to follow through with these trade sanctions, the levy of 45% import tax, which has been bandied about. So I think if that happens, China will need to react and retaliate. And I think, and I'm obviously speculating here, but I think Xi's idea is to see if there can be some agreement to this. In my mind, I think North Korea is our top priority and will be discussed extensively, but I think Xi's goal is to avoid a trade war.
Don't you also think that Xi is maybe going to be, I don't want to use too strong a word here, but pleading for the United States to stay on board on the Paris Accord in terms of climate change?
Yes, actually, this is. I find this incredibly ironic that China is taking over the position of the advocate of, you know, stopping climate change. And yes, she will be. I don't think he will be. I think he'll be trying to persuade the administration to do this. I don't think he'll be pleading, but I think he will try to persuade the advantages of staying with the Paris Accord. It's actually becoming a top priority for the Chinese.
What do you think about Jared Kushner, who clearly has a fairly strong lack of experience, but is suddenly being sent to the Middle East, is also being had talked to some Chinese bankers and so forth, and there may even be some conflicts of interest there. But what do you see as his role? Some are speculating that maybe Steve Bannon wants to kind of move him out of the way. I don't know if we can speculate on that, but what do you see his role as being?
Well, I think he has been tasked to arrange a lot of these meetings, which is fairly unusual since that's usually done by the State Department. But right now, there aren't necessarily the full complement of people in the State Department to arrange all these. So Kushner has been tasked to do this. Interestingly, though, for the Chinese, at least, perspective, this is not unusual, right? The whole use of family members is fairly common in Chinese culture, and that includes government officials. But in terms of our perspective in the U.S., he certainly has recently gotten an official title in the White House, but if he pursues interests in China in terms of business development, then there is clearly a conflict of interest going forward.
And again, Anna Han is Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law, and Orville Schell is also with us, directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations in the Asia Society in New York City. And one would presume also, Orville, that at least high on this list of priorities would be, well, relations in Asia overall and China's role.
Yes, I mean, I think the whole sort of puzzle has been thrown on the floor. Not only did Trump raise questions about the sort of fidelity of America to our alliance structure, which has now been somewhat clarified, but we have the Philippines, which is a traditional, very close American ally, sort of running away under the aegis of Duterte with China. We have South Korea in a state of sort of political implosion with the impeachment of their president and an election pending, when we don't really know what the disposition will be of the new South Korean president towards the alliance, towards North Korea, towards hardline, softline. So there are a lot of uncertainties, and I think this is sort of one of the most basic building blocks of American influence and America's ability to sort of stabilize things within Asia, and that is to keep a very strong commitment to Japan and Korea and Australia. So that's sort of one steadying impulse. On the other hand, China's very much on the march. They built their islands in the South China Sea. They've militarized them to some degree. And now this year, their agenda seems to be to kind of back off a bit and make nice and refriend the countries in Southeast Asia, which were getting quite nervous. But with the U.S. in a state of ambiguity, possibly pulling back, we do see a certain amount of hedging of bets of those countries, as if to say, well, we're not sure we can count on the U.S. We better throw an anchor to windward and buddy up with the Chinese a bit. And I think the Philippines is sort of the hood ornament of that whole movement.
We need, I think you have set a roadmap for the South China Sea, clearly, even though they may be backing off slightly. I'm wondering, though, you know, there's been a lot of talk about and saber-rattling aimed at North Korea, but we have a couple of people in the Trump administration, i.e. Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, who said war with China is likely.
Well, I think, you know, their perspective is that we do have fundamental antagonisms. We have very different political systems and values, and China's sort of incipient hegemonic tendencies, which they view as sort of deriving from history, that China has a right to kind of be the hegemon in Asia, and the U.S. has been sort of an uninvited guest in the region and should pack up and go home now that China is wealthy and powerful and back. So there is a kind of a presumption and there, this is a whole school of thought in sort of political science, that rising powers inevitably must clash because there's a they're seeking to displace the existing power. So who knows what's going to happen on that front? It's a very delicate balance, and it's going to take some tremendously sophisticated diplomacy to accommodate China's rise without pushing it to the brink and finding, you know, the spark that lights the prairie fire in the East or South China Sea, where there's constant dangers of clashes.
When Orville Schell mentions the rise of China as a power, Susan Shirk, we now have three major powers, world powers, China and the United States and Russia, although some would argue that Russia is in bad economic shape compared to the United States and China. But we have cybersecurity concerns with China as well, as we do with Russia, not to the extent, not to the degree, because Russia interfered with our election. But what are we going to do about that? And will that, do you think, come up even in this meeting, which is not a state meeting like it was? It's more like a meeting with Abe, the Japanese prime minister.
Well, the Obama administration did make some progress with Xi Jinping in establishing some limits to the cyber hacking by getting Xi Jinping to agree that it was out of bounds for the government to try to hack into businesses, to commercial firms, to try to get their intellectual property or their commercial secrets. And actually, we even have a procedure whereby the Homeland Security and law enforcement people on both sides talk together about specific cases and try to identify this kind of cyber hacking in order to enforce the ban against it. And then we took that notion that it should be ruled out of bounds, so we took it to the G20 and started to develop a kind of global norm against it, which I think was a really good way to go. Starting with bilateral and then moving to the multilateral. And the people who know, who see the classified information about this, report that actually there has been a reduction in China's hacking of our businesses. So that's some progress. It could mean, of course, that they've just found better ways of disguising it. But, you know, I don't think that's going to be a central focus of this meeting, because it's, you know, they only have a limited amount of time. And as your other speaker said, our highest priority is North Korea and China's need for some reassurance on how we're going to handle the trade and investment disputes is probably their highest priority.
But if, Anna Han, the Chinese are indeed concerned, as you indicated before, about climate change, and the irony is they have sort of shifted place with what was the Obama administration's main role in all that, the United States may not withdraw from the Paris Accords, but certainly the United States under President Trump is working against climate change. There's a whole battery of essentially doing away with regulations that came out under the Obama administration, and How do you think that squares with China's concern about climate change?
Well, I don't think we're being consistent, but for China's purposes, they're more concerned with international agreements, what we do domestically in terms of our own deregulation is really the U.S.'s business as far as China is concerned. So I don't think they will be terribly concerned about that. They would like U.S. to stay in the Paris Accord because it is an international joint effort. The real question will be then, can we meet our obligations under the accord if we deregulate to the extent that we are heading towards?
And Orville Schell, in your report, you were talking about concern over the Chinese haranguing journalists and actually denying visas, all of this kind of stuff that has been blocking websites that has been characteristic in many ways of Chinese behavior. I don't know if this is going to come up at Mar-a-Lago, but I'd like you to comment on how we can make progress on that, or can progress be made with this new administration?
Well, of course, the Trump administration is not renowned for its vigorous support of a free press. And it is even, I think, less renowned for injecting questions of democracy and human rights into relations with other countries. We saw this in stark form with Trump's meeting with the president of Egypt. I do think, though, that the question of how American media outlets are treated, their websites are all blocked, there can be no distribution in China of any newspapers, television, radio, or anything like that. Whereas here in America, China has the run of the pen. There's Central Chinese Television, Radio International, People's Daily, China Daily. There's no restrictions whatsoever. And this, in a way, I think, is a metaphor for the way in which many aspects of this extremely important bilateral relationship are out of level, they're out of balance. And it's true in trade and investment, it's true and certainly in civil society, and there are many other areas. So I think how Trump goes about doing this, I'm not sure. I doubt he'll pick up on the media, but he may pick up on something like the prejudicial way in which visas are issued, namely that China has blacklists for scholars, journalists, NGO people, even businessmen that they don't like, whereas the United States tends to issue visas in a more ecumenical manner. So it's this lack of balance, this sort of prejudicial protectionist mentality that extends from trade and investment into these other areas that I think is really important to get leveled up again, because if it isn't, you lose constituencies in America for a healthy, constructive, and full-bodied U.S.-China relationship. The last of the main boosters for sort of no-fault China U.S.-China relations was, of course, American businessmen. And if you look at their sort of take their temperature now as compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you see even business becoming much more sort of unhappy, jaundice about their prospects of doing well, about the meeting a level playing field.
Arvo, excuse me, I'm going to have to cut in here because we are coming up on a break, and I wanted to invite listeners to join this discussion talking about the rather crucial relations bilateral between China and the United States, and really talking about the two priorities that will be broached presumably in this meeting at Mar-a-Lago between Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump. Trade and trade imbalance and the call for a 45% import tax by President Trump, what that means to the Chinese, North Korea, and what can be done, cybersecurity. I mean, we've certainly touched on a lot of the main issues, South China Sea and Chinese hegemony there. You may indeed want to weigh in here, and I invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. You can join us at that number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, so feel free to join us now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Susan Shirk, Anna Hahn, and Orville Schell, and you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Trump are set to meet on Thursday. In the midst of rising tensions, they're going to be meeting at the Trump estate down in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, and there's much for them to talk about. This summit actually comes in the midst of rather tense relations between the two nations over different strategies and views toward North Korea and China's military presence on islands in the South China Sea, and President Trump's repeated criticism of China's trade policy. We're previewing the visit, and we're discussing the current state of U.S.-China relations with Susan Shirk of the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, and Anna Hahn, who is with Santa Clara University School of Law, an associate professor of law, and Orville Schell, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City. And Orville, I had to interrupt you there because we went to a break, so I wanted you to have the opportunity to finish your thought, if you could.
No, I think I was just at the end. Thank you.
Well, let me actually go to another question then with you, and then we'll get our callers involved in this, and that is China's clearly, you know, becoming well, positioning itself as a world leader in Asia. We talked about the importance of this meeting and ongoing relations in terms of the whole continent. But there's the rather considered opinion that President Trump has created kind of a vacuum of sorts in Asia compared to at least what the Obama administration was doing with the more positioning itself toward Asia.
I think he certainly has lofted a number of question marks over the U.S. His ability to continue on as a global leader. We'll have to see how it all resolves. I think China does have a kind of a very strong yearning for global respect and views playing a larger and more seminal role in global politics as a way to get this respect. And I think it does have an urge to move into vacuums left by the U.S. On the other hand, I think it also has a recognition, as do many others in the world, that it's not ready to do that. Moreover, one of the things which I think compromises it severely in ever being able to take over a really significant global leadership role is its political system and value system, which is really quite inimical to at least the liberal democracies around the world. Now, having said that, I have to also acknowledge there seems to be a global trend towards illiberal democracies with China, Russia, Turkey, Hungary, other, even Poland, Egypt. So this is a world in a state of very, very uncertain but tectonic change. And if the democracies of the world continue to sort of founder, who knows what's going to happen? And who knows whether this other kind of axis that seems to be just forming now, of which China would be a huge piece, will come into some more coherent form in the future.
Let me go to your calls, and I remind you, you can join us either by phone at 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org or by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And here's our first caller. This is Common. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering about the Japanese and how much they might be paying attention to this meeting with Trump. I know that they've been kind of very anxiously looking at China and as well as us, looking at if we're going to uphold our treaties. So I'm just trying to see what they're paying attention to and what they might think happened at this meeting.
All right. Let me go to you on this, Anahan, if I could. What do you think? The Japanese are certainly concerned about what might come from this meeting or better relations with China.
Yes, I think they are paying attention. The Trump administration's view on foreign relations seems to be a transactional one. What have you done for me lately and what can I get out of it? And that's the way it's viewed during the campaign. He talked about Japan paying for its own defenses, which, of course, worried the Japanese whether or not the United States will stand by it as an ally in any situation. So given the tensions in the East China Sea, I think Japan is worried, and they have been, I think, quietly, as Orville just mentioned, looking to see if they should be on friendlier terms with China. And to not exactly switch alliances, but to at least hedge their bets. So I think Japan would be watching this very closely.
Yeah, and let me thank the caller and go right on to more of your calls. Let me go to Peter next. Peter, you're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. I'd really appreciate hearing from your guests some ideas, some concrete measures that could be offered as a goodwill package to North Korea, along with all the the bad options that we've heard about for negative defense.
Susan Shirk.
Sure. Well, the idea of a new round of negotiations is that we would let North Korea know that we take their security concerns seriously. That presumably is why they're developing nuclear weapons and missiles. And we're going to tell them that they would be safer with better relations with the United States and with their neighbors. And that means a peace treaty to replace the armistice after the Korean War, which is still exists on the peninsula. Also, steps toward diplomatic relations with the United States in exchange for North Korea freezing its nuclear and missile development and taking some real steps toward ultimate denuclearization, closing down those programs, which they had previously committed to do in the context of the six-party talk. So that would be the main positive incentive, addressing their real security concerns. And, the problem is, how do we convince them that we're sincere about that, just as how would they convince us that they are no longer going to cheat in developing their weapons of mass destruction? There's so much ill will that it will be very, very difficult for them to believe us. But on the other hand, once you start talking, you know, maybe some of that mistrust can be dispelled.
It's
very unlikely, and every indication is that the Trump administration has rejected the idea of a new round of negotiations. I mean, in our report, we say that we have to try it, because otherwise we're not going to get China's cooperation in ramping up the pressure on North Korea. And it's worth giving it another try, because all the other options are so bad.
And let me add, by the way, Susan Shirk's been talking about the report from the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. It's up on our website if you want to read it. And I want to read a comment from a listener, actually a question of sorts. Let me go to you on this, Orville Schell. Ben writes, currently, China holds the most power in the U.S.-China relationship. China owns $1 trillion worth of treasury bills, produced over 50% of products consumed in the United States, and has developed a scientific community that now rivals the ones in Europe and the U.S. Looks like the 21st century is going to be a Chinese century. What power really does the United States have? Orville Schell.
Well, it is true that they have a lot of treasury bills and U.S. securities. But it's also undeniably true that if they start bailing out, the value will plummet and they will lose substantially. So we sort of have them locked in. I'm not particularly fearful about that kind of power, because it is not a power that's exercisable. I think, as to whether China is going to rule the world and America is in decline and we're going to have a Chinese century, I'm not so sure about that. China has been extremely impressive in its economic development. That is not to be denied. But there are tremendous amount of structural weaknesses within the Chinese political system and economic system that, are going to be very difficult to deal with going forward. So there may be some big bumps in the road. We want to remember back to the 80s when we thought Japan was going to rule the world, and then we saw what happened. I do think we have to be ready, though, for China to be a major player. And the best of all possible scenarios, and this is what engagement always aspired to effect, is that the U.S. and China learn how to rebalance the global equation to get along, because as your questioner rightly posits, we are deeply integrated and our interests in many ways are bound up with each other. But again, there's an awful lot of disagreements, and I don't want to overdo this, but it does get back to the fact that the United States and China have incredibly different views of history, politics, values, and the way they believe they should be governed. So this is a fundamental contradiction that constantly throws up dissonance as we try to recalibrate and rebalance. And there's a tremendous amount of distrust on the Chinese side, because they've spent 100 years viewing the U.S. as imperialists, as colonialists, oppressors, various other terms apply. And we've viewed them as a kind of communist, conspirators out to rule the world. So we have a pretty bad historical narrative between us to overcome.
Well, that historical narrative, if anything, may have been exacerbated when President Trump started talking about two Chinas, or, doing away with the one China policy that's been in place for so many years. But the reality is that there's backtracking on that, and I presume that backtracking will continue. The policy of one China will continue. Let me go to a listener remark, and you, Professor Han, Anna Han, with us again from the Santa Clara University School of Law. This administration, a listener writes, isn't about advancing democratic ideals. It's about money and deals. Can something positive come from this?
Well, potentially, yes. I think this meeting has a couple of purposes. One is to see if they can build some kind of rapport and direct dialogue. They've never met before, and Trump is not what you call your usual politician where there's a track record for someone to assess. So I think that's important. To the extent that dealing is something that he's used to, then there can be some agreement potentially on trade. As I mentioned earlier, I think to talk Trump away from imposing this kind of astronomical duty would be one good step, because I think that would be something that would be disastrous, not just for China, but it would also hurt our consumers tremendously. There's two sides to this coin. So the answer is yes. I think there can be room for negotiation, which is something that I think both are willing to do.
And another caller joins us. Wynn, you're on. Morning.
Morning. Thanks. In regard to the delegation that we're putting together for this for these meetings, do we have any idea whether they have any diplomatic experience or prior dealings with China, or do we just have a gang of novices that are likely to be snookered?
It's a good question in light of Jared Kushner, Susan Shirk. We can't tell us, especially since there's a lack of bodies right now in the State Department.
Yes. I'm not sure who is going to be in the room. That's something we're all going to be looking for. I mean, is Steve Bannon going to be in the room when these two leaders talk to one another? I sure hope not. And the problem is that the different parts of the Trump inner circle appear, and the cabinet secretaries are all jostling for influence with this as yet unformed Trump policy. And we don't really know who's going to win this battle. And at the same time, there's a very thinly staffed State Department, Defense Department, National Security Council. So these professionals in the State Department, and I have great confidence in them. I've served there, and they're excellent at their jobs, but they're not getting very clear direction as to how this president wants to handle China. And they're sort of scrambling to figure out what kind of talking points to put before him. And then, of course, the question is, will he follow those talking points at all? And who else will be in the room? We really don't know.
Let me thank Wynn for his call, and let me go right on to another caller. Matt, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thanks very much. We've all heard about hacking, stealing business secrets and secrets from the Office of Personnel Management and so on. But what's going on between the people, that is the intelligence officers on both sides who work in the respective embassies? Is there a secret intelligence war going on?
What do you think, Orville Schell?
Well, I think, you know, this was an area that deeply alarmed the Obama administration. And as Susan Shirk pointed out, before Xi Jinping made a trip to Washington, basically the Obama administration said the trip is in jeopardy if we don't work something out. This has come to, you know, a point where we're not going to just continue to roll with it. And indeed, they sent the Minister of Public Security over in a matter of days, and they did hammer something out, and there does actually seem to be some significant effect as a result of that. Now, this shows that this is a real problem, the sort of cyber hacking, whether it's of private companies or of government secrets. I think the U.S. admits that governments hack governments. So there's not much you can do on a moral basis to shame China there. But this question of hacking businesses is another story. I think it'll go on, but it does illustrate that when the United States stands up and says, we've had enough, sorry, there are now going to be real consequences if we don't straighten this out, China is able to jump to it and get a remedy, because in actual fact, and we should never forget this, its relationship with the United States, as fraught as it is, and as much as they sort of propagandize sometimes against us, is extremely important to them.
Again, Orville Schell directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City, and let me thank the caller and go to another caller from New York. Mary, join us.
Hello. As much as I think we would all love to imagine this Trump is brilliant, he's a good business person, whatever, I think we all know that he's a useful idiot with no clothes, right? I think that there's no grand plan for Jared Kushner except to educate him on the taxpayer bill. He gets to go to all these places. He gets introduced to all these important people. We've paid the bill, and when Trump is out of office, Jared has all these connections and business things that he can make money on later.
Well, Mary, forgive me. Since you're calling from New York, there's been some speculation that maybe this is the way to get him into politics, to run for senator of New York, perhaps against Schumer even.
You know, him and Ivanka, I'm sure there's some grand plan, but we're paying for it. And are we going to get anything great out of it? I doubt it.
All right. I thank you for
really
that call.
Doubt it.
Appreciate it. You know, that's really the bottom of the speculation behind our whole discussion today. What can come out of this, and what can President Trump, who has been utterly unpredictable in so many ways, really accomplish here at Mar-a-Lago? I'm looking at a question from a listener. Let me go to you in this. Anahan says, how can the nations of the world, perhaps led by the United States and China, address North Korea with an offer of love and the promise of true and lasting welfare of its people? What concrete measures might be offered to North Korea and its human population to meet legitimate human needs?
Well, I think there are certainly offers that are available if there was the will to do this. And I do believe China would play a pivotal role in that, in presenting such an offer if it came to pass. One thing I would imagine would be a large sum of economic aid. The people in Korea are in very poor condition in terms of health, in terms of just daily subsistence, in terms of all of the things that they need. I think that would be great if the North Korean leaders would accept it. That's really the question, because if you're asking them to give up security, as Susan mentioned earlier, that's not something the North Korean leaders are willing to give up. So you can offer aid to the people. The question is, will the leadership accept it?
And Susan Shirk, let me go to you with a question from Jack, who says the problem with the economic relationship between the United States and China lies with the value difference between the dollar and the yen. The value disparity is driven by the fact that the U.S. allows foreign direct investment. If China would allow foreign ownership, there would be no issues.
Well, that's a complex story. China has appreciated the value of its currency, the renminbi. The problem is the U.S. currency has appreciated even more. And actually, China has been trying to support the renminbi and prevent it from falling. If it were allowed to float freely, it probably would fall much more. And so shutting off investment entirely is probably a really bad idea, especially if you want to create jobs in the United States. And we also want to continue our access investing in China. So putting a wall between the two economies is probably something that would be so damaging to the United States. We wouldn't want to do that. I might mention that our report recommends that in addition to enforcement of our trade rules and laws, which we need to do more of, that we should also try to work with China to help reinforce their own declared commitment to deepening market reforms and opening of their economy. You know, we heard Xi Jinping say all these wonderful words about a free and open global economy from the platform at Davos. And what we suggest is that our government work closely with the Chinese economic officials to develop a roadmap of supporting those domestic reforms and opening by having China sign on to more of the global trade agreements, that together, for example, we ought to finalize a bilateral investment treaty so China will open up more sectors to foreign investment. It should sign the government procurement agreement of the WTO. There are a whole bunch of steps that we can take together, and we can do that in a more collaborative manner, not by hammering them or threatening tariffs on them.
But that's what President Trump was doing throughout the campaign. They couldn't have been deaf.
Well,
to all
yeah,
that.
But but it's not going to really help the United States, and he is going to have to back down from a lot of this bluster. He has been backing down from his bluster in a lot of other areas. And what we're providing is a kind of roadmap where he can maybe make some progress, improve the U.S. economy, create jobs in the U.S., and do it in a way that reinforces reforms in China and doesn't become a trade war.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me go to next to Fim. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to make a comment on China-North Korea relationship. Many people want to think that, you know, China is supporting North Korea, but things have really shifted over the years. I want to make the comment that if there's some maniac in your backyard cooking up a bomb, I don't think any country or anyone will be okay with it. Just because two countries are both communist country, it doesn't mean that China is supporting North Korea on everything it does. That's my comment.
All right, and I thank you for that comment.
Can I comment on that?
Susan, sure.
Can I jump in here? Yeah, I've been talking to Chinese friends in the last few weeks, and I agree with the caller that public opinion and elite opinion in China has really turned against North Korea. The assassination of Kim Jong-un's brother in Kuala Lumpur, a person who has basically been operating under Chinese protection, living in Macau, was so insulting to China, showed that they had no respect for China's face, China's interests. And the missile defense that South Korea and the United States are deploying in South Korea is something that Xi Jinping feels is very detrimental to U.S. interests. So, I mean, he doesn't have a lot of popular pressure to be friendly and support North Korea. And, you know, I think that if he could find a way to do more to help Trump in this regard, expand this area of cooperation, he would not find any or not much public opposition to doing that within China.
And let me go to another caller here. Jane, thank you for waiting. Join us, Jane.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. While I'm listening to this program, I have a practical question. We have a perfectly good White House with a perfectly good staff who have been trained over many, many years to set up for heads of state. Why does Trump have to take these people down to Florida? My opinion is he just wants to show off. We don't have any proper press to cover them down there. Is China going to get a fair shake in our media? And I would like to hear what your guests have to say about that. What is this costing the taxpayers of this country to have this president entertain the way he does where he does it?
There's been a lot of articles on that. You can find them online about the cost, particularly the security costs and the rest of it. But let me go to you on this, Orville Schell.
Well, I think the question of whether the press gives is fair to China or to the United States. I think, you know, the press in this country is in a great state of duress right now because the business models are collapsing underneath it. However, I think that Donald Trump paradoxically has given a boost to many of the newspapers and cable channels. I do think, and being a member of the media myself, watching it very closely, I think the better media outlets, but certainly not all of them, struggle very, very hard to be fair. To be, that doesn't mean they won't sometimes take sides, and you see them more and more, I think, lining up against Trump, because Trump is capable of saying the most mendacious and outrageous things. As to China, again, China does an awful lot of, it wants respect, but it does an awful lot of things make it very difficult to respect them, and I think they should be called out. And I think that's the job of the press, to try to be a watchdog, to try to look at things honestly and fairly. And whether you like it or not, to report them.
Actually, Orville, I should jump in here because according to the New York Times, which admittedly is no friend of President Trump's, China, I'm just reading here, China had pushed for the more relaxed atmosphere of a meeting at Mr. Trump's resort rather than at the White House. That's what American officials are saying, at least.
Well, I think that's probably not, it's probably a good idea because the Chinese can get awfully wound up in ritual and ceremony. And I think this was Obama's notion out at Sunnylands, and Trump is just trying to replicate something like it, I think, in Mar-a-Lago. That'll probably cost the taxpayers less to have them down there in Washington, actually.
That will conclude our discussion. Thank you, Orville Schell. Orville Schell, again, directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City. And thank you, Anna Han, who is Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law, specializing in Chinese law and international business transactions. And thanks also to Susan Shirk, Chair of the 21st Century China Center, School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. You can read their report online. And we thank you for being with us this morning. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larborg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. Another hour ahead with Jane Meyer. We're going to find all about Robert Mercer and dark money. Stay tuned for that. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.